A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Alison Rudd. Thank you for joining us. In the studio with me, it's the superb football journalist, Julian Leron. And down the line, we have The Times' chief sports writer, the excellent Matt Dickinson. Later on, we'll decide if the Premier League was right to procrastinate on VAR, and we'll examine how Southampton let 3 points in the bag fall out onto the pavement when they weren't looking. But first, we'll look at the game that meant Pep Guardiola could win the title while playing a round of golf. I think it's no exaggeration to say that when Manchester City turned up at Wembley to face Tottenham, a lot of people who know a lot of things about football thought history could repeat itself, that Manchester City's dip in form, this perceived frailty, could rear its head again, because Spurs are a good team. They are as classy as Liverpool sometimes. They can catch you on the break with incisive football. Individually, there are some fine, fine players. It never once looked like that, and I wondered if we could dissect why that might be, Matt Dickinson.
Well, I guess a few things. I mean, first of all, we should credit City for, you know, I mean, we've lauded many of their gifts over the season, but I suppose this one, first and foremost, was resolve and focus and the mental side of it when the three-game blip was causing a lot of questions to be asked. I personally thought, you know, that maybe they're going to be a bit soft because they know they're going to win the league. So, you know, are they actually going to be able to sort of regroup mentally? But that just shows Pep Guardiola, you know, is as good at tapping into the minds of his players as sometimes he is choreographing that wonderful football. So, yeah, first of all, mentally they got it right. I guess the Spurs back line, I think, still has its moments. Sanchez, you know, obviously didn't have a great game. City looked like they were trying to exploit behind that back line. A couple of few early balls using pace, above all orchestrated by De Bruyne, who was... Some of his touches were just breathtaking. And I just thought, overall, I was just thrilled for City that they put on a performance like that to remind us why they are winning the league, why they deserve an awful lot of the plaudits. Because, you know, it would have been a shame if it had been a sort of damp squib of a title triumph.
Yeah, no, exactly. Just you mentioned Raheem Sterling. He's had a lot of grief over analysis of this game because... He's missing more chances than he's scoring, and yet he's putting them away. He's one of the league's top scorers. 22 goals this season, which is no bad return, Julian. And why do people, given he's part of an excellent team, really, why aren't people just saying, lucky City, they got Raheem Sterling playing at his, not quite his peak, but clearly on a trajectory to be his peak. He's improved on last season. He was told by his manager to get 20 goals. He's exceeded that. So why are people giving him grief?
Maybe for the chances that he misses, and some are big chances. Some are chances that a player like him at that level shouldn't be missing. And maybe that's why people are not completely convinced yet. I think Guardiola said it after the game as well, saying, like, you know, he needs to score more. He needs to finish better, because he could have easily had a Mo Salah season. You know, he could have had 40 goals with all the chances that he missed. He's just not there yet. Does he have it in him to become... a 40-goal-a-season striker? Personally, I'm not sure. I think maybe 22, which is already very good, or 25, might be the maximum that you could get. I don't think you can become a lethal striker. I think you have that in you. You can work hard and improve your finishing. But to get to the Harry Kane level, or even the Mo Salah level that we see now, if he can reproduce it, or the Aguero level, I don't think you need to have something different in you than other forwards to be a striker like that. And I'm not sure Raheem Sterling has that. But like you said, it's still a very, very good season. And I think people and England fans and Gareth Southgate as well should be very excited to have him.
Well, I think that's really interesting that you compare him to Mo Salah. Because Matt, Mo Salah, he's nowhere near on the conversion rate tables. He misses a lot of chances, but nobody complains about it, partly because he scores more than Sterling's 22 goals, but partly because people know he wasn't expected to come to Liverpool and score that many, so it's like a huge bonus. But equally, Raheem Sterling wasn't expected to score 22 goals. So I just think it's partly because he's English and we're protecting ourselves and he's not going to be the star at the World Cup we'd need him to be.
There may be a bit of that. I mean, on the conversion rate, I mean, as you say, Salah's obviously missing a few, but he's scoring. In terms of perceptions, he's obviously confounded them, because much as I think we were sort of intrigued by Liverpool signing him, none of us expected this. And I guess, you know, we do need next season to find out if this is an outlier, whether, you know, he is a 40 goals a season man, or has just had one of those astonishing years when, you know, things just fall into place, your confidence soars and everything seems easy. On Sterling, I'm with Julien on this. It's you know, he deserves praise. Guardiola deserves praise for making him a better finisher. But, you know, there is still a but, you know, and it's if he wants to become, you know, he's gone from, you know, very good to a very good player. If he wants to become, you know, start sort of getting to the next tier, he needs to be nailing more of these chances, and it's simple as that. And then, you know, in crucial Champions League, you know, deciding matches, in international deciding matches, in tournaments, you know, these are the things that make the difference. Just that reliability of a chance has fallen to him, he'll finish. You know, we've all seen those players that just have that, you know, that sort of sense of, yeah, we're in good hands here, and we're Sterling still. You know, you sort of cross your fingers when he's one-on-one, or, you know, so it's, he's made progress, well done for that, but, you know, he's still a tier below what he could be. And it's, again, I agree with Julien on this, you don't know if he's got that sort of dead-eye killer about him, and we, you know, only he can prove that, and he still has to prove it.
Yeah. I'd just like to dissect briefly Davinson Sanchez. I mean, sometimes these things are skewed. When I've seen him live, I've not been overly impressed, but I thought he had a particularly strange game against City, and I'd like someone to explain why a defender starts off marking someone, in this case Gabriel Jesus, on one side, ball comes over from Kompany, and he runs around Jesus, which means that he's just not going to be positioned well or near enough to be able to cut out the shot. Julien, try and explain. I don't know, I'm baffled. Why would you do that?
No, I think he has issues with positioning. I think tactically, I'm not sure the Ajax Academy, although he didn't spend many years there, but I think you learn more about technique than about tactics, yeah, especially as a centre half. But even technically, he's not the greatest. It was a weird one, because I think he had like 4 clearances, 3 block shots, so he clearly has, you know, good ability as a centre forward. But I think he was just all over the place in his positioning, and maybe he expected a bit more pressure on the ball from his teammates, which should have never allowed Kompany to hit the ball the way he did for the Gabriel Jesus goal. Because if you play such a high line at the back, you expect pressure on the guy from the opposition who is on the ball. Otherwise, they just pick their passes like they did really on Saturday. So maybe he was a bit surprised with that. But that still doesn't justify the crazy positioning that, not just in this game, but through the season, he's had some good matches, but others where he was just all over the place. And he's still a very young defender, and I think the World Cup will help him a lot growing. And I'm not sure, you know, I don't think he was supposed to play that many games this season. I think, you know, the Vertonghen and Alderweireld were still very much the core of this Spurs defence. The issue with Alderweireld, with his injury first and then the contract issues that he's had with Spurs, made Pochettino play Davinson Sanchez more than I think he would have wanted for a first season, with all the, you know, adapting and etc. to the Premier League. So That's why maybe as well he looks a bit lost at times.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
That's going to be a key part of their summer business, isn't it? I mean, obviously, the expectation that Alderweireld moves on, and they will have to buy a replacement who's ready to step into a first team. So, yeah, be interesting to see where.
And no one expects Alderweireld to be at Spurs next season, then?
No.
I mean, the release clause of 25 million kicks on in summer 2019. So if they want to keep him, they can, but he will go for 25 million in a year time, well, a bit more than a year time now. So surely they should try to sell him for a bit more now, which is worth more than 25. So you would think it would make sense for them to sell him for more than that this summer.
We've analysed the match, but there's a bigger picture here, and that is congratulations to Manchester City for a thrilling season. In the game on Monday, today, if you're listening close to when we transmit this, we've got a lovely explanation, if you like, by Paul Hurst of exactly how Guardiola built a team fit to sweep all before them. If you're a City fan, it's a must read. In fact, it's something you'd have to stick on your wall if you're a City fan, because there's a beautiful graphic where they show every single goal City scored in the league and explain them as well. It's really nice. I'd read through it, and one thing that, I don't know why, made me laugh out loud, which shows I've got a huge sense of humour, is Paul Hurst. He's talking about the way, first of all, he's analysing how Guardiola works, how he operates. And he tries to dismiss the myth that Guardiola is authoritarian. And he asked his players, "Do you like the way we play?" He asked them in a training session. And the unanimous answer was yes, says Paul Hurst. But it made me laugh because I just can't imagine a single City player putting their hand up and saying, no.
I want to park the bus.
Can we park the bus? It just made me laugh. And also the idea that when it's going so well, anyone would dare suggest that they wanted to do it a different way. It's very, 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 it just made me laugh.
I like the picture of Guardiola walking around the training ground in his socks all the time, which certainly jumped out. The attention to detail doesn't go down to wearing shoes, clearly, but no, it is a fantastic piece. It's just every paragraph is rich with another new detail, and it's exactly the type, we're just top reporting by a guy who's immersed in the Manchester scene.
Yeah, and the stats are just, it's just so nice when a team has won something that takes, the league is important because it takes the whole season and you face so much luck, bad luck, good luck, you face the right team at the wrong time and so on, so get injuries or whatever. There's so much to absorb into it. And then the stats just let you know that, yes, they won because their goals per game ratio was 2.8. Their shot conversion rate was 16. All of these statistics are so much improved on what they did last season. So it's a really lovely read. But Matt, there are two things I don't like about talking about, and I'd like you to sort of avoid these, which is how can City improve next season? Let's just enjoy what they've got now. And I want you to say what has been the highlight for you, why you feel they are worthy champions, not just worthy champions because they got the most points, but worthy because you've enjoyed watching them. And you said earlier you were pleased they ironed out their glitches and started to show us again why they are deserved title winners.
Well, yeah, I mean, I love, I'd like to see them break the records, because who wouldn't? It's love to see them break points records, goals records, because they're clearly capable of that. And I guess overall I'm most pleased that Guardiola has not compromised. I mean, I think there was a great debate when he came in about how will he adapt to English football, and I suppose one of the great things is that you could say he hasn't, in the sense that he has his very clear principles of football that we know about, and it's based effectively most simply on control the ball, and the other team can't do a lot about it if you have 70% of it and know what to do with it. And then on top of that, obviously, it's about the quick movement of it, the overloading in certain places, quick switches of play. And when you've got players like De Bruyne, Silva, Sane, Jesus, Sterling, and so on doing it, not to mention Fernandinho, who's actually been probably the sort of almost the unsung, I think, star at times, it's been thrilling. And Guardiola's done that without compromising. He's been full bore, this can work. And obviously we've seen the hiccup against Liverpool. Klopp, better than any other coach, seems to know how to counter it. But the joy has been that so few others have. I mean, we should say, and this is going to sound sort of like I'm diluting it, that it's, you know, it's not a great top division at the moment. I think there are some, you know, Liverpool are a very good team on the rise. Spurs can be an excellent team, but, you know, United are still rebuilding. Chelsea have been all over the place. So it's not like they've been pushed by a top team, but if they had been pushed by a top team, I think, you know, they would have withstood that. Overall, the highlight for me, as an individual, De Bruyne has just been the joy for me. And certainly remember, you know, early season, it was a sort of no-brainer that he was going to be player of the year, obviously, till Salah sort of made his charge. And the fact that Guardiola has won it through his methods in English football, and I think that can only be good. You know, it's about skill, it's about ball retention, it's about control, it's about using your brain, it's about intelligent movement, and it's about often diminutive players succeeding in a league that we're told is all about power.
Yeah, Julian, I mean, from a neutral point of view, do you think this is a particularly popular outcome for the Premier League season? Will fans of other clubs in England and around Europe have looked at what the Premier League has produced when City are playing and thought, oh, I'd like some of that?
Surely, they're beautiful champions, aren't they? It's been a pleasure to watch, whether you were at the stadium or in front of your television or listening on the radio. I think it's been great all along. I don't think there's one game, even the Liverpool defeat or even the Crystal Palace draw, that was not entertaining for one reason or another. Obviously, they deserve this title. They deserve to break all the records that I hope, like Deco, they will break this season. There's still room for improvement, which is encouraging for them and worrying for all the opposition. I think if they had had Benjamin Mendy, a left back, through the whole season, they would have been even stronger and even better, because Delph, Zinchenko, Danilo, even Walker, when they play that left back, are nowhere as good as a Mendy would be, because he would be the Walker of the left side, if you want, and they would have been so much better with him. So I'm looking forward to seeing him for a full season in that team. And you know they're going to also recruit one or two, maybe three quality players that Pep still think will improve this team somehow. So I think it's been great. I think they will keep being great. And if the other don't catch up next season, it could be the same again. I think Liverpool would be stronger, and for me, they would be the strongest opposition that City will have next season. But it would be good if we had other teams than just Liverpool challenging them.
Yeah. What stands out for me, weirdly, is probably because I was at the defeat to Leicester last season, and the 4-2 defeat, and afterwards Guardiola did his relatively famous, you know, tackling, what is tackling? And there was this sense that, oh, he doesn't get English football really, does he? He's not going to do that well if he doesn't understand you've got to tackle. But he continued to say it. He didn't go away in the summer and say, oh, I've analysed tackling and I'm going to make sure we practice tackling in coaching sessions. He continued to say, no, we don't do tackling. It's not about tackling. My teams are not about tackling. And he's won the title, as both of you might have intimated, by doing it entirely the way he wanted to do it. I mean, that's an incredible amount of, some would call it arrogance, perhaps, but it's so clear-minded what he wanted. Just finally on this, do either of you in any sense feel the glory of it is diluted by the fact he spent 400 million quid?
Not if you build a team that's beautiful to watch like this. I mean, it has to be thrown into the mix. You know, when you're asking how they won the title, it's part of the conversation. It would be odd if it wasn't. But if you know, I think we are naturally more forgiving, understanding, tolerant of that kind of spending when you have a plan and you pull it off. And obviously, the plan includes winning the Champions League, and that bit's yet to happen. But if you build, you know, say if you take that, we've seen enough of those sort of tens and hundreds of millions squandered by other clubs not doing anything special with it to be too catty about City spending it to build something that's just magnificent to watch for anyone week after week.
And I think all the big clubs all around Europe are spending money. I mean, Virgil van Dijk is the most expensive defender in the world. He's not playing for Manchester City. You know, and I think he has the money available. There's no problem between City and financial fair play, which means that, you know, they can spend money that they are earning. It's not money that they've stole. They have it. They're spending it well, like Deco just said. Why wouldn't you? I mean, any manager would want to spend money and more, as much money as they can. And I think he's doing that. Mourinho is doing the same. Klopp is doing the same. Maybe not on the same level, but if you want to build a very strong team, you have to spend money. Barcelona do it, Real Madrid do it, PSG do it, Bayern Munich do it, Juventus do it. Maybe, again, not all at the level of City or PSG, but they're still doing it.
Yeah, but interestingly, he might not be manager of the season because eventually money comes into it. And what managers such as Sean Dyche do, ultimately, people think they feel admiration for because they have so little to work with.
True, but Sean Dyche is an amazing manager who is improving his players. Pep Guardiola is an amazing manager who is improving his players who are...
Whose
values is higher than the Burnley one. If Sean Dyche was the Manchester City manager, would Manchester City have won the league the way they did? I'm not sure. If Pep Guardiola had been the Burnley manager this season, I think they probably would be in the same position than Burnley are now.
Oh, but we'll never know. And I would watch that programme. I would watch that team swap. A timely reminder that this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League and the FA Cup. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Which brings me to the Goal of the Week section of the show. Matt, what was your favourite goal of the weekend in the Premier League?
I have gone for Newcastle United, their opening goal against Arsenal, which I think was a decent passing move, but finished with a cross to the near post and beautifully tucked away, sort of running to the head of the near post by Mr. Perez. I just thought it was one of those great, swift cross finish that just... Yeah, had a bit of wow, and beautifully done, and sent Newcastle mad. They had a day of celebration yesterday, and it's always good to see St James's Park, something like that.
Julian?
I went for Mo Salah's goal.
The right answer.
Yeah, of course. Alison, I knew you would like it. For a few reasons. One, because it's his 40th of the season, his 30th in the league, which no African players had never done before, and 40 for Liverpool in one season, only Ian Rush and... someone else I didn't know had done it before a long time ago. I love the ball from Trent Alexander-Arnold, who I love the way he picked himself up after the terrible game he had against United, and that ball was magnificent, and the finish from Salah is just so intelligent and with his head, which is quite rare to be fair as well. So well done to Mo Salah.
That man can score any type of goal. Right, let's go to the South Coast. I was there, so I'll set the scene. It was a day of unbroken sunshine as Chelsea travelled to Southampton. Actually, I find this hard to believe with hindsight, but there was a festival sort of atmosphere. If you'd just landed from outer space, you wouldn't think Southampton were a team in trouble. There was optimism pervading the stadium. The team responded in kind. They played with intensity, a certain amount of freedom. They certainly played optimistically. They took the lead. Ryan Bertrand just storming down the wing, making Azpilicueta look a little bit too short and stubby and slow. Nice finish from Tadic, a player who's often accused of playing better for his country than his club, but he was rising to the occasion. And then the whole thing seemed sorted in the bag because they took a 2-goal lead with their young Polish international, Benarek, making his first Premier League start. Boy's own stuff. He'd come into defence because Jack Stevens was suspended and he played well and then he scored and everyone was happy. And then there were 8 hellish minutes if you're a Southampton fan. Giroud came off the bench, scored twice, and Hazard got one in between. And suddenly you look at the table, you look at the matches left, and you're thinking, how did that happen? Afterwards, Mark Hughes said he watched those 8 minutes and thought, why weren't my players more cynical? Why didn't they break up play? Why didn't they commit fouls? Just be clever at game management. They're too honest. I was there. I couldn't really see what more his team could have done other than give away penalties. I mean, Julian, do you know what Hughes is on about? Do you see a naivety in Southampton?
Maybe. I don't think you get into the position they are with, I think, the quality that they have if you don't lack something in terms of the right aggression at the right time in the game, maybe a bit of cynicism or be a bit more vicious, maybe especially when you're in winning positions and you're controlling the game. However, I think what I was a bit baffled with is, again, Mark Hughes' tactics. I mean, straight after the second goal, Conte puts Pedro on. for Zappacosta, which changes the way Chelsea were going to play. I mean, it was obvious to see, even me in front of my television, that if Pedro replaces Zappacosta, you know that the Chelsea team is going to attack differently. And yet, there was nothing from Hughes to try to set up his team a bit differently, maybe, or do something, because you could see it coming. You could see it coming. And with Giroud then replacing Morata at the same time as well as Pedro, you know that, okay, now it's going to be a different Chelsea team for the remaining 30 minutes. And I was a bit disappointed that Hughes just let those 8 minutes and those three goals go in without really doing anything. And it's only after that he made his changes, by the way. Charlie Austin, Sims and someone else came on after that, and it was too late. And then you don't come back. I don't think you come back from that. So I get his point about his players maybe lacking a bit of experience at times. But, I mean, I think he has to take a bit of the blame too.
Yeah, no, he was. He could certainly be accused of deflecting it from being his responsibility by saying that. And he said also he's still finding out who his leaders on the pitch are. Matt, do you think they're down? And if you actually pause to think about it, it's quite remarkable that they could be going down, because Southampton were a club we've spent quite a long time lauding the way they're set up, the way they plan ahead, the way they bring in managers who fit the club philosophy. They saw Pochettino. The fans weren't happy him coming in, but he hit the ground running. Just the way that club has been run and the way they've sold massive profit. It looked like, briefly, it looked like the perfect way to run a football club. Matt, how did it come to this?
I think they are going down. I think that sealed it, to be honest. I think the bottom three, I mean, unless Stoke pull off a shock win away at West Ham tonight, I think it's done. I think those West Brom, Stoke, Southampton will go down, and as you say, Southampton are probably the stark one of those, because their squad is, you know, way better than third bottom. I mean, you know, you see a team like Huddersfield who are going to be staying up by the looks of it, and think, you know, Southampton must have really screwed up. I mean, I think there's been a bit of complacency has probably set in. This will never happen to us. I've seen a few comments from players that certainly seem to have reflected that, of sort of, you know, we're better than bottom three. I think obviously managerial changes, you know, have Hughes has come in too late, and I'm not sure he was a bounce manager in any case. I think under Pellegrino there were two. I've got a mate who's a Southampton season ticket holder, and he just said that it was, you could just see motivation levels drop by the week. It felt moribund. I mean, Puel tested the patience in terms of sort of watching attractive football, but he just said it felt limp. It felt like a team that didn't actually believe it, you know, somehow felt it was above a relegation scrap, and they say it just sort of sleptwalked into it. And they're going to become a bit of a cautionary tale, aren't they? I mean, I guess, you know, you let the money for Van Dijk becomes pretty hard to turn down when it reaches that level. But that, again, fuels just the idea of a team that sort of never quite felt this was going to happen.
Julian, now with hindsight, do you think they got lucky with Koeman and Pochettino and never seemingly to suffer when they had to sell a player for a large amount of money, usually to Liverpool? Mm-hmm. Or are we seeing the real boardroom in action now? Because they've made a succession of poor decisions.
I've said it before, and it's not me being French, but Claude Puel, I didn't get it. And I know the football was not the sexiest, and I understand that the fans didn't get a lot of pleasure from watching the team, but it's a team that finished eighth and reached the League Cup final that they probably should have won against United. And Puel always said that was the first of his third-year contract, that he wanted to build on a very, very strong first year and then develop a better style of football. They didn't even leave him the time for that anyway. And after that, it was always going to be a tricky decision. You have a manager for 1 year who had, you know, certain ideas, and then you bring someone else who had one very good season in Spain, but that's about it all. You keep him for a long time, even when things were not going. You gave him a lot of money to spend in January, and he signed Guido Carrillo from Monaco, who he worked with before in Argentina, who hasn't scored a goal since. And you're thinking, like, you know, you kind of deserve to be in that position, yeah, after all those wrong choices. And Van Dijk, like Dico said, is one of them. Because if they had known in the summer that he would go in January, which seems to be quite the case, or at least Liverpool were quite confident that would be the case, then surely they should have prepared the post Van Dijk a bit better than they did, really. And you have to feel for them to be in that position, because I agree again with Dico that they are better than a lot of the teams that are above them in this table. But you're also...
You do reap what you sow.
You indeed, reap you what do. You sow. Yes. And in a case, I think that's Southampton's season.
Matt, it seems to be set up rather poetically for the Claude Puel derby on Thursday. I mean, he's going to be... Claude Puel, I mean, is going to be pretty keen to... Is he? I don't know. Would you think he would be keen to sort of rub their noses in it? Rub Southampton's nose in it? Because if they lose against Leicester, that probably really, really is it.
I tell you, Claude Puel doesn't strike me as the type who's going to be dancing on the pitch like David Pleat or doing anything too demonstrative. But yeah, there is a little sort of a classic sort of football poetry to that. But I just think I think their last game's against City as well, isn't it, Southampton? And I'm certainly expecting them to be doomed before then, just because there's certain times, and I think we did see it as soon as the tide turned against Chelsea, when you sort of see the players. The dip was so instant. I mean, to let in three goals in 8-9 minutes, whatever it's, you just see that here we go again, sort of almost resignation about them. And I think that to me looked fatal.
Quick word on Chelsea and the way Antonio Conte decided to drop Antonio Rudiger, who's been one of the standout performers as far as I'm concerned for Chelsea this season. Just got gradually better and better for him. As far as I am aware. Conte was dismayed by the way Rudiger analysed the draw against West Ham in the previous game. He really wasn't that critical. He just wondered why they were unable to see out a lead. And he was unceremoniously dropped. Is this good management, Julian, or peculiar management?
It's Antonio Conte's management.
And it's what he does.
Yeah, that's what he does. He's been doing it the two seasons that he's always being like this. I think last season, when you're winning and you're top of the table as a player, you cope with things maybe a bit better. This season, a lot of players, I think, from what I've been told, haven't been so happy by the way that, you know, he's taken the team, really. And that's why I think his tenure at Chelsea is going to end at the end of this season. But Rudiger didn't make sense. I have Gary Cahill there, who was, I mean, you were there, Arthur was pretty average in that
again,
game.
Again. Yeah, again. I mean, he's quite clearly just gone past his peak now, and he's on his way down.
His way down, I think we all agree to that. Yeah. Didn't make much sense either. I don't know. And again, I think Olivier Giroud deserves to play more. It's probably a bit the French in me, but I don't understand why Alvaro Morata keep getting a starting place ahead of him. And I think he showed on Saturday what a valuable striker he could be for this team if they play on his strength. And I expect him now to play a bit more, hopefully, until the end of the season.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Right, the debate this week is, we've done it before, but this is slightly different because the Premier League clubs they've had a vote since we were last on air, and they've decided that they don't want to dive in there and have VAR, video assistant referees, in the Premier League next season. They want other competitions to keep practicing for them, basically further trials. VAR, it's weird actually, it's been used in 16 domestic games so far, and it feels like a lot more. 3 in the EFL Cup, 13 in the FA Cup. The big question is, why wasn't that enough to reassure the clubs that it should be a permanent fixture next season? Was the experiment itself not done very well, Matt? What do you think?
Well, there's a bit of that. I think it will have to stay in the game. It must stay in the game. It's just been a question of how, you know, we implement it. And I do think there's been a couple of fundamental mistakes in the trials that have been done that have upset a lot of people. And it's a shame because a lot of people have sort of entrenched themselves of, this is a joke, it's a shambles, it's a disgrace, when, you know, I think in any sensible world, VAR will stay. It's just a question of the most workable system. And I think the main two, obviously, biggest errors are, one, communication, you know, to the fans inside the stadium first, and then obviously to home, that should have been much better thought through. I sort of understand why it wasn't, because the first priority was to help the referees and get the sort of work on the game side of it, but they should have realised that there was, especially in football with the huge fan following, that there was going to be a backlash on that and thought that through. And secondly, the pitch side monitor bit, which I know I've been against. You know, the initial trials didn't involve a pitch side monitor, which takes up more time, it sends the referee over, it delays things, it puts more pressure on him, and, you know, a referee has to rely on his linesman a lot of the time just to say, you know, foul, red card, penalty, whatever. And he should be able to rely on the guy with the TV just to say, look, you've missed a penalty there, or you've messed that one up, change your decision. And that trust needs to be there, which would be a better system. So those are two big improvements that, you know, shouldn't be beyond the realm of mankind to work that out pretty simply. I'm disappointed with the Premier League in the sense of this system is going to happen. I think it's slightly cowardly way out that they've sort of said to everyone else, well, you iron out the glitches for us. To wait another whole year seems a long time. For once in my life, I find myself agreeing with a head of FIFA who says, look, you know, we've got to just dive into this and make it work. Because the fact is, the trials, yeah, the Premier League talk about more trials. They're worthless, really, because very hard to do trials of a system without just trying it, because, you know, you can't, how do you trial the break in the game? How do you, you know, you ultimately you only find out by using it and improving it, and I've already come up with a couple of obvious improvements.
Julian, Arsene Wenger said it was a dreadful decision by the Premier League. It just means we're falling behind the top leagues in the world. Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Dico as well. I think I'm disappointed that they voted against. I don't really understand why you wouldn't want to take it on. Of course, there will be at the beginning, there might be a few issues. We saw that in the Bundesliga and Serie A as well, you know. So it's still a work in progress. But why wouldn't you go on the work in progress bandwagon like everybody else? I mean, for the Premier League, who is, and, you know, says it quite loud, the best league in the world and the most competitive one, etc., why wouldn't you want to have VAR with you and to have the help of video assistance? And even if it's not completely perfect, and it might never be completely perfect. So what, if you don't find it perfect, you will never have it. It doesn't make any sense for me why you wouldn't want to have it and help it getting as close to perfection as possible.
I think part of the problem is we need to know how come in Germany they've embraced it, for example. How come other leagues have managed to go with it? I think it's partly because the starting point is different. In this country, there is mistrust about refereeing. It's become the fabric of how football is, that you don't always trust the officials. And that has been exacerbated, that when we have had VAR, if the match has been shown live on television and the broadcaster has access to a recently high-level referee, they go to that referee and they ask them, what's happening here with VAR? What's happening? What will the assistant on his monitor be thinking? What's going on? What's he hear? What's the referee hearing? And the answers you get from the people in the studio have been often quite abysmal. For example, in the Champions League game where the Sané goal against Liverpool was deemed to be offside, and pictures showed that it wasn't because Milner had a touch, I think BT Sport had Chris Foy in the studio. They went to him. They didn't go to him immediately. They gave him a minute or two. And he analysed it in absolute I think he was embarrassed with what he said, actually, because he said it was a goal, and the logic he gave didn't make grammatical sense. Mm. I suspect he asked to go back on air at half time so he could try and clear up what he'd said. But the point is, it makes you think, oh, if he'd been the person in charge of the monitor, really, does VAR help if you've got somebody who's struggling to explain what's going on to the man in the middle? I just don't think, as a cohort at the moment, the way referees portray themselves, I don't think there's the trust there to start with. It doesn't matter whether it's someone live with the responsibility to make a decision or it's somebody who's in a studio looking at all the angles will make it any better.
But the thing is, that, you know, the communication thing, I can see why that's annoyed people, but VAR is not going to make the game worse in the sense of, you know, it's improving some decisions, getting them more accurate, and occasionally it can't resolve a problem. So, you know, we're still in the same issue. It's a 50-50 decision. You know, Michael Oliver, given that, you know, penalty against Juventus, I think, you know, he makes that decision, and I think, you know, even if the VAR slightly disagrees, he goes with it, because the whole point is he only overrules when it's a big error. You know, and that hasn't made the game any worse. It's just given a backup system. You know, there's been so much instant judgment, though. I think that the world of punditry has got a lot to answer for. That there's been, you know, people like, you know, who I generally have, you know, can have time for. So Alan Shearer, I remember saying, it's a shambles on one occasion, and someone else, so this is a joke. You know, there's been such a rush to judgment without actually, I think, a lot of the time people understanding that how the system works, what the point of it is. You know, yes, it can be improved. It must be improved. But there's been such a... I wrote a column some months ago about is the English game even mature enough to sort of handle the nuances of VAR? And most of the evidence has been that it isn't, sadly.
But you've regularly reported on VAR, Matt, and you wrote our news story about the Premier League vote. What sort of off-the-record kind of vibes were you getting off the clubs?
Well, basically, there's a full range. There's you know, a handful that think they should have cracked on and just got on with it and, you know, deal with the glitches as they come. West Ham, Man City, Arsenal, among those who I think are, you know, open-minded and intelligent about it. Steve Parrish, who I otherwise find the sort of entertaining company, but is on this, I vehemently disagree with, is that he's the one most at the other extreme, who sort of, I think the fan in him doubts whether this can ever work and is sort of set against it. And he, you know, he kept, I'm told, sort of, you know, shouting, that not shouting, but sort of interrupting to say, oh, don't like this and don't like that. So there was a full spectrum of opinions. Ultimately, it needed 14 votes to push ahead, and there were enough people, I think, sort of sitting on their hands, and I think basically taking a bottling out of it, who sort of allowed it to be fudged for another year.
I mean, there are other positives as well than just the video. If you look at in Italy, the number of dives have gone down drastically since VAR came into play in Serie A, because players know that if you dive, the referee can easily go back, give you a second yellow, for example, or something like that, which, you know, at least is good news for Dele Alli that we won't have VAR next season for the diving. I'm only kidding, but there are other positives, less fouls, for example, because again, you know that on the foul you could get a red card if the referee has missed it on a bad foul. And I think there's so many other things than just, okay, you know, that can help the referee about this. There's all the other things around VAR, like the diving, like the less fouls, that would help the game to be even better.
And so, the abuse thing as well. I mean, you know, somehow they're going to have to work out this communication thing. I mean, you know, I've thought about, you know, whether refs, you know, obviously they are mic'd up as it stands, but no one can hear what's being said. But, you know, if it gets to the point where, you know, a referee is having to explain what's been overturned, maybe we're listening into communication, but, you know, anything that makes it more public what players are saying to referees, I think, great, because, you know, again, I've been a long-standing sort of my sort of big hobby horse is the whole culture of abuse in football, and I think VAR can somehow, must help to sort of push back on this whole culture that you complain about everything, every single decision in football.
Time now for some quick hits. I'm not going to dare tell Gab Malcotti this, but I think the time for silly noises while intelligent people are talking has gone. Ooh. I'll just trust you chaps to keep your answers brief, but if they're interesting, keep going. I don't care. Matt, Wolves are back in the Premier League for the first time since 2012, and I'm sure we've all missed the renditions of Hi-Ho, Silver Lining. Are you pleased they're back?
I am pleased they're back because, I've watched a lot of Championship football and they stood out for obvious reasons, and I'm intrigued by their coach-manager, who I think is... I'd heard good things about Nuno Santo before, and I'm really intrigued to see how he gets on. Obviously, the Mendes links are going to, well, just make it more interesting. Are they troubling to a small degree? But I think there's a lot of jealousy from other clubs, and they're a classic modern English football story of sort of a combination of sort of foreign influence, agent influence, and good football.
And do you ever find yourself singing along to Hi-Ho, Silver Lining when you hear it, Matt?
Even after 75 pints of lager, you would never catch me singing along to that. And if there's any footage of it ever, late at 3 a.m. at some wedding somewhere, I deny all responsibility.
Fair enough. Arsene Wenger really has put all his eggs into the Europa League basket, but their defeat to Newcastle mean they've yet to win away from... Indeed, they've yet to get a point away from home in 2018. Do you know why this is, Julian?
I think psychologically there might be an issue there. I think his rotation to mostly keep the best players for the Europa League ties can explain it. However, it's just not acceptable. I mean, 5 league away defeats in a row for the first time since December 1984, I think. It's the only club in the top 4 leagues in the country not to have a point away from home in 2018. I mean, come on, this is Arsenal Football Club. And guess who the next away game is at Manchester United. So it looks like it could even be a 60 feet in a row away from home, which would be even worse, I guess. But let's hope for him that it all pays off and they win the Europa League.
There was as you've mentioned, Matt, there was a party atmosphere at St James's Park. Rafa Benitez has quietly guided a team many felt would be relegated to 41 points. How has he done it?
He's done it by using all his wiles and experience, hasn't he? I mean, we all know he's a shrewd organiser of teams. He's a good coach. I mean, he tests certain players' patience, I know, by being so painstaking. But, you know, it's worked at Newcastle. He's kept his experience in a turbulent year of all the usual nonsense off the pitch at Newcastle, ownership, etc. You look at the way he's improved individuals like Shelby. You look at the way he's I think, probably made one mistake with Mitrovic, who's obviously gone to Fulham and banged in a load there, and that's one question mark. But other than that, he's brought out the best of the resources in a critical time of the season. And it's intriguing to see a Twitter argument about whether he should be Arsenal's next manager going on last night. He's certainly put himself back up there among the very good coaches.
I think Mitrovic could really only play for a fellow Serbian. It's just the way he's built. Burnley could be playing in Europe next season, Julian. What will Europe make of them?
My word, it will be amazing. And I hope they do, because after a season like they're having, they deserve, that's the carrot you play for almost. And it will be amazing for them. First time since 1960-61 for them in Europe. And, well, Europe will make of them a very well organized team, as we know, but it would be interesting to see how they cope with with Europe, which is a different offering than the Premier League, and maybe a lot of teams who wouldn't know them as well as the English teams. So it'd be very, very interesting, and also to see if they can cope with playing in the Europa League, let's say, on the Thursday and then in the league on the Sunday, and see if Daesh can do it over playing 2 games in a week, if you want, compared to just the one game a week that they've had this season. And maybe that's why they're doing so well. But they would need more players, a bit of more depth, keep their star players, and then just enjoy your European adventure.
Yeah, it'd be good fun. Antonio Conte spoke of seeing fire in his players' eyes, but there was not even a flickering flame in the eyes of Manchester United's team. Is this unacceptable, Matt?
Well, it is. I mean, it's, I know... what have they got to play for? Well, just sort of delaying City's fun. But it just back to my point of, City being excellent, but the following pack have all had their sort of different flaws, and the fact that United are second. Thank God City did put in the season they have, because the idea that they would be sort of anywhere near Championship standard just doesn't add up. I I mean, it's funny, you know, 1 week they're beating City and you think, oh, a piece is falling into place, 4-3-3, Pogba given that sort of free eight role, Sanchez sort of back where he played for Barcelona, and a week later they're stinking the place out against West Brom. I think Julian mentioned that maybe Liverpool will be City's closest challengers next season. You know, I wouldn't disagree with that, unless United really, really show, you know, just Mourinho shows where this team is going. Big players like Pogba, Sanchez, what their role is and how they're going to thrive week after week, because we don't know yet.
Julian, who would you pay to watch right now? Kevin De Bruyne or Mo Salah?
Oh, you're mean to do this to me. You know, I paid to see them both in the Manchester City-Liverpool Champions League.
Did you?
Ties. You see why I did that?
Oh, very good.
I would pay... Do I really have to choose one?
Yeah.
Yes, you do.
Oh.
We all have to this season because we're voting,
don't we? I'll pay to watch Mo Salah. I just think it's an incredible story. It's an incredible achievement. It's an incredible season. And he's an incredible football player. So
I'll disagree there, just to balance it out. I'm going to have to vote for De Bruyne as Football of the Year just because everyone else is going to vote for Salah. I'm feeling sorry for him.
Ali, one for you. The World Cup is virtually days away, as we were talking about before we recorded this show. What did Gareth Southgate learn this weekend?
Oh, if I was Gareth Southgate, I'd be livid with the organisation I work for, that they're just not cleverer when it comes to harvesting talent. To see Wilfried Zaha for Palace, the best player outside the top six, decide, because he was neglected for 4 years after playing in a friendly in 2012, made to feel like he would never have any chance with England. So he went off, and who would blame him? I don't blame him. He played for the Ivory Coast, who wooed him and said, you will play. So he played for them. It's not enough to say, oh, it would have been cruel to make promises you can't keep to Wilfried Zaha. If you're going to win something on the world stage as England, you've got to be more ruthless from the very start. And you've got to, what do they all do all day? They aren't actually training anybody. So they can go out and watch and find out who is going to have the potential. A player with the pace of Zaha, who Alex Ferguson saw as a potential star. It wasn't Wilfried's fault that he came to United in the summer that Ferguson retired. That went wrong. But in the intervening time, he's matured. You know, the stats are amazing. Palace cannot win without him. He's so important. And his pace. Imagine him running at a tired defence of any calibre at the World Cup. He'd be a great option off the bench. Absolutely. Or go for it and have him and Sterling running at a defence. But if you're Southgate, you don't have that option. The other thing this weekend that would have worried me is the England defence. It seems somehow to have become built around John Stones, who's invisible at Man City, either with niggling injuries or his manager thinking he's not good enough. In his last outing for England, he did look a bit like he's going to be error-prone if he keeps trying to walk the ball out of defence or be too composed. And who's he going to play with? I mean, I'm a fan of Harry Maguire and the Harry Maguire story, but of late he's looked fairly ordinary. I don't know. I don't think from an England point of view it was a great weekend for planning. That's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Julian Laron and Matt Dickinson. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Just search The Times online. And this season, you can access highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League and the FA Cup. We'll be back next Monday to assess how much of an advantage it was for Spurs to host their FA Cup semi-final against Manchester United.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.